Please be advised that the following program may contain content not suitable for younger children. Then again, it may be the perfect thing for older children who you think have started using drugs. Broadcasting from the gulag city of planet Earth, this is Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth about the drug war. My name is Dean Becker. Our engineer is Steve Nolan. In just a couple of moments, we'll have our guest for the evening, Dr. Rick Doblin, the president of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. But first, let's get a quick report from last week's guest, Mark Emery, about his smokeout of the Canadian Parliament.
It's a wonderful experience. Parliament Hill is so unlike the American experience. Like, for example, we were all able to smoke huge joints. The police cooperated with me beautifully. They called me up yesterday to confirm. They even asked me if I needed anything. I felt somewhat like John the Baptist, giving people sort of like a strange Vatican-like toque for good spiritual health or something, walking around. And it actually had more meaning to me to be able to do that, because I got to look at everybody who was taking a toque and speak to them at that time. And like I say, this is 50 feet in front of the front door of Parliament.
It's time to play Name That Drug by Its Side Effects.
It's expected that people are going to get into difficult emotions and difficult experiences. The dark night of the soul. People will have these kind of struggles, emotional struggles.
Our answer from Dr. Rick Doblin.
Psychedelics.
Okay, not to make light of the subject at all, Dr. Doblin and I had a discussion about the likely contents of this program last week, and I expressed to him some of my thoughts, not about the correct usage of psychedelics, but rather that some might mistakenly think we're condoning widespread use of psychedelics, and we're not. That's why the little warning to parents and the drugs by its side effects bit for, you know, the intro. Now, having said that, let's go ahead and bring in our guest for the evening, the president of MAPS, Dr. Rick Doblin. Good evening.
Yes, Dean, thank you for having me tonight. I'm looking forward to talking with you.
Well, yes, sir. It's good to have you here. I want to start off with the thought that people have been using, you know, one drug or another for as long as we've been on this earth. The war on unpatentable drugs, even though it's 88 years old as of this date, is really a recent phenomenon, a minor blip on the timeline of mankind. And I want to ask you, just first up, why does drug prohibition exist, what perpetuates it, and what's going to bring it to an end?
Well, those are some mighty good questions. I think that the human tendency to scapegoat, to find other explanations for problems rather than one's own limitations, I think that's really a big part of it. Drugs are a convenient scapegoat for parents, for the society. Racism, economic competition, that's how we started out with the laws against opium smoked by Chinese laborers building the railroad, Mexican laborers during the Depression who used marijuana. So I think there's a racist component to it, a puritanical component to it. Certainly that was a lot what was behind prohibition. So what's happened, though, is over the generations, it's taken on a different meaning. Drugs, in particular marijuana, and psychedelics have become to be seen as symbols of cultural rebellion. And so for many things, drugs are a symbolic politics. Now I think there's just such enormous misinformation that have been propagated by the National Institute on Drug Abuse and anti-drug groups that parents are often just scared. They don't know what to do, and they somehow fall back on this punitive prohibitionist strategy, which really doesn't work to the advantage of their children or themselves. But I think we've got prison industrial complex, we've got economic reasons to sustain it, we've got cultural reasons. There's no real rational, logical, medical reason to support the drug war. And I think that it will come to an end over the next 10 or 20 years as the enormous costs, the self-defeating nature of it, the limitation on the benefits of the beneficial uses of psychedelics and marijuana and other substances, even cocaine, tea, would be probably much more beneficial than abused in terms of its consequences. So there's just going to be, I think, a transition back. We are, as you said, in a historical anomaly, this prohibition, and that many cultures over, most cultures over the course of thousands of years have found ways to successfully integrate the use of these drugs. I think what we've got to do is show for those parents that are scared, those families that they want to protect, that the drug war only makes things worse. And also for those people who are behind the drug war, I think we need to show them that there's a higher calling, fight against other sorts of violent crime, terrorism, much better than going after pot smokers. And also, we need to show that elderly people who might not be from a drug-using culture or generation, that particularly MDMA can be helpful. We're trying to start a study at Harvard Medical School looking at MDMA for the treatment of anxiety, depression, and pain in end-stage cancer patients. These are people that wouldn't normally take a psychedelic, probably have never done it, and yet MDMA is sufficiently gentle and deep to help people deal with difficult, fearful situations. So I think all of those things, the other part is the economics. What we really need to do is say that if we integrate this into our culture, there'll be probably, I mean, this is just a guess, but somewhere in the neighborhood of $5 or $6 billion per year in annual taxes from marijuana that's now going to the underground. And this should go into the tax revenue, I think. And we need to do similar studies about how much money would be saved by not having marijuana prohibition. It's probably another $5 or $6 billion. So we're talking about $10 billion a year for a country that's under severe economic stress. And what's it for? It's all for symbolic politics, and the symbols don't even reflect reality. They're so far divorced from reality that it's really time for a change. So, Dean, sorry for going on so long.
No, no, that helps to understand, you know, your perspective, and I appreciate it, Rick. There's a report came out in today's New York Times written by Jane E. Brody. It's titled Addiction, a Brain Ailment, Not a Moral Lapse. And a quick quote, it says, addiction should be considered a chronic medical illness. And my question is, so why are medical decisions given over to the criminal justice system? Why don't the doctors take that responsibility back?
Well, doctors actually are heavily regulated by the government. So they're in some ways a conservative force. And the government has very little trust in the doctors. I mean, when you start talking about handing things over to doctors, you know, from the point of view of the DEA that tries to control drug diversion, there's always going to be some bad apples in every bunch, and some of the bad apples in medicine would really set up prescription mills and just let access to these drugs go to anybody, whether they had a medical reason for it or not. So I think that the doctors feel vulnerable because of the few bad apples. They also are, their fees are regulated. There's just a big, strong interaction between, you know, what the U.S. Congress thinks and how much money doctors make and how health insurance is structured, all sorts of things like that. So that doctors have been co-opted in some instances, but more and more doctors are really starting to focus on trying to pierce through this veil of misinformation and really understand what's going on with medical marijuana, with other aspects of the medical use of MDMA and psychedelics. So I think that the doctors are really not going to be the leaders. They're more of a conservative force. The nurses are doing pretty well. The nurses have actually, American Nurses Association had a statement recently about medical marijuana that was really powerful.
Oh, it was. We had a couple of guests on to discuss that. I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank on their name, but
Mary Lynn Mathery.
Yes, indeed. Her and her husband.
Yeah. And so I think that there's some hope for doctors, but right now it's sort of like a policy vacuum. I mean, there was drugs were unregulated, and the criminal justice people came in and said, well, we're going to take in charge of that. Now, marijuana was made illegal in 1937, and that was shortly after the end of Prohibition. We had a bunch of Prohibition agents who were used to going after drugs. We had Mexicans using marijuana in the middle of the Depression, mostly, also blacks, musicians and otherwise. And there was just a grab for power, and the doctors lost out. The AMA was against the criminalization of marijuana, but when Henry Anslinger and others went to try to get Congress to approve the criminalization of marijuana, they claimed the AMA was for it. So they have, the doctors have been outmaneuvered by the police in an area that should be returned to the doctors, and I think that that is being blocked very skillfully by the drug czar's office. Right now, if you want to do research with marijuana, you have to get the marijuana from the government. They have a monopoly on the supply of marijuana that can be used in research, and they make extremely poor quality marijuana, and they don't even give it to every FDA-approved protocol. Several of them they've refused to give it to. So we have a major limitation on the development of marijuana as a medicine. The government is successfully hindering privately funded research. It's taking place with some modifications in England with GW Pharmaceuticals that's growing marijuana for marijuana extracts. I think that we really need scientific studies. That's what will convince the doctors. The government is trying to block them. The pharmaceutical industry isn't working in these areas of illegal drugs very much. I mean, GHB, the date rape drug, was made into a medicine. FDA approved it very recently for a narcolepsy.
Wow.
That actually went through Congress in a very interesting pattern. That was the first time ever, maybe it will become a pattern, where the non-medical use of GHB is in Schedule 1 and all the penalties associated with that, and then the medical use is in Schedule 3. So it's much easier for doctors to get them. So it's the first instance of a same drug bifurcated scheduling according to how it's used.
Well, that's some good news indeed. One last thought on this, the medical establishment. Out in California, there's a situation where there's very few doctors who are willing to step forward and write recommendations for the medical patients. And Dr. Todd Micaria out there is, one of those who stood boldly because he studied marijuana the most and he understands it's not that much of a danger. And they're trying to punish him. What's your take on that situation?
Well, I think it's like one of the things that Timothy Leary said that very much impressed me. He said, if you want to be a bridge, you have to get used to being stepped on. You know, Todd is trying to be a bridge to the 21st century. We're still not quite in it, it seems, where cannabis-based medicines and cannabis itself will be considered accepted medical use and prescription use. And so Todd is trying to step into the breach where other doctors are scared to go, and he's become a lightning rod, and therefore, the same way that the DEA went after the best-run clinics in California, the Buyers Club, the Oakland Cannabis Buyers Club, Valerie Corral's place in Santa Cruz, they go after the ones that are doing their best to cooperate, to act in an honorable way, to act out in public, to do it above ground, and they become targets.
Indeed. Okay, well, Rick, we're going to get to the heart of this. We're going to talk about more about psychedelics, but we're going to take just a one-minute break. We'll be right back.
Basically, the idea is to change political consciousness in this country so that our children, hopefully our children and certainly our grandchildren, look back on the drug wars of the last few decades and of today with the same sort of distaste and contempt and even horror that we look back today on the Jim Crow laws and the slavery in our own nation's history.
Ethan Nadelman, Executive Director, Drug Policy Alliance, drugpolicy.org.
Dr. Rick Doblin.
MAPS, which stands for the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, psychedelic meaning mind manifesting, which includes psychedelics and marijuana, the nonprofit membership-based research and educational organization with the goal of developing psychedelics like MDMA, perhaps even LSD, and marijuana into FDA-approved prescription medicine.
MAPS.org.
Okay, that music was not Pink Floyd. That's Us and Them, and they're going to be in town this week at Fitzgerald's on Friday. Want to alert the listeners, this is Pacifica Radio. You're listening to Cultural Baggage on the Drug Truth Network, and our guest is the man you just heard, Dr. Rick Doblin. Okay, Rick, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, people have used these drugs, whether it's magic mushrooms, peyote buttons, or marijuana, for thousands of years. Is there anything to be afraid of, and what do we gain from that usage?
Well, there definitely are things to be afraid of. I think we need to be very careful not to fall into the trap of being the opposite of what the government says. If they say they're all bad, then we say they're all good. I think that's really a trap, because the tendency is to kind of focus on the positive only when the government is doing its best to highlight all the negative. But really, with psychedelics that have been used for thousands of years, and even the synthetics like LSD that have been invented more recently, the main concern is not physical harm to the body. Not to say that there aren't some issues where MDMA would raise blood pressure. MDMA can increase heartbeat. There are, some physical concerns when you dance all night with MDMA. If you don't have adequate fluid, if you don't cool down every now and then, you can overheat, and some people have died from that. But basically, the physical, there's really nothing from LSD physically. There's no chromosome damage, no brain damage, no organ system damage, nothing. Similarly, there's very little of concern with psilocybin, with mescaline, with marijuana. There's not a single case of anyone, not a single documented case in the medical literature of a marijuana-only smoker with lung cancer, which is a pretty amazing thing to say. After all these years of people smoking pot, there's nobody who's smoked pot, never smoked cigarettes, that has gotten lung cancer. So physically, there are some concerns. Under the wrong circumstances, they can lead to death or other kind of physical crises. But the most important issue, I think, is psychological. The reason they're used, these drugs, are used psychologically for religious purposes, for psychotherapeutic purposes, for healing, sort of the mind-body connection. And I think if people approach these drugs just strictly as recreational tools, just to have a party, just to have fun, and if they're not prepared for the deeper emotions to surface, we've talked to people who have gone to raves, taken MDMA, and during the rave started reflecting, memories started coming back of prior sexual abuse. And if they were in a position to open to that, to think about it, to work through it, they can make a lot of progress, and they have. But then there's others that have contacted us that a similar thing happened, and they felt that they were with a group of people that were just going to have fun, and they were feeling even worse, that they were bringing everybody down, and they tried to suppress their emotions, and they ended up feeling really bad for a long period of time. So I think the emotional issues with MDMA are you prepared to deal with difficult emotions? With other psychedelics, they're at higher doses, they're certainly taking apart, their ego dissolving. They take apart people's sense of self, people's ability to think in a rational way. And when they're used in psychotherapy, there's a sitter or two that takes care of all the external reality, so to make sure it doesn't impinge upon the person who's doing it, meaning that they just are there to answer the, make sure the phones and the doors and the, nobody comes by. People have a safe space, and they also help therapeutically as people get into difficult positions. But when people take these drugs recreationally without that kind of support, they can actually have extremely frightening situations. There's an event not too far from Houston. Well, it's pretty far, actually. Burning Man in Nevada, farther than from Boston. And MAPS just did psychedelic emergency services. We just provided that at Burning Man. And there were several people every night that had LSD or whatever experiences, which whatever psychedelic, that they just couldn't handle. It just was too much. And they either panicked or became catatonic and quiet or just very anxious, and they came to us, and we worked with them to help them deal with the underlying fears and to let them feel safe. And several people we actually ended up spending hours and hours with in sort of unplanned psychedelic psychotherapy.
But it is good you were there. I mean, it kind of harkens back, if I recall, the 60s, the 70s, where people talked about proper set and setting, and that's very important, isn't it?
It's crucial. Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, the proper set, it's sort of the mental set, what you bring to it. I mean, in the olden days, in the different cultures, people grew up in the cultures that had these psychedelic rituals. And they were educated about them and trained, prepared to participate in them from young child. And in fact, one of the things that we have that I think makes things more difficult rather than actually improving the situation is our age limits. I mean, they're widely violated. In Europe, you know, people learn how to drink at home more often than not. And there's large amount of alcohol consumption in Europe, but lesser amount of alcoholism. And drunk driving, other problems. So that there's a way where people have learned to integrate it. It doesn't mean no use. It doesn't mean excessive use all the time. There's ways to integrate it, and that's what we lack in our culture. I think that there's a lot that we can learn from the past, a long way to go to implement those things. But overall, if people don't have the proper mental set, if they're not really prepared for the full range of emotions, or if they're just really feeling anxious, if they don't feel safe, they can end up having serious problems. I mean, think of it as a surgeon's knife, you know, into the mind. And you could do tremendous work with somebody. Neurosurgeons can do just tremendous life-saving work. Or, same tool in the hand of a criminal, you can die. I mean, that's what I think psychedelics are like. They're more neutral tools. They're not inherently good. They're not inherently evil. Our government wants you to think that they're inherently evil and will lead to all sorts of physical and emotional problems. And I think what we're trying to say is that in the proper setting, with people that have been properly prepared, with people who are worked with afterwards to integrate the lessons that they've learned, that psychedelics can be tremendously useful and beneficial tools. But it really depends upon the willingness of the individual person and the courage that they have to face their inner issues and try to work with them, and then also the context.
Right. Rick, I want to ask you something. We touched on this with our discussion of last week, and I'm wondering if you can help me understand just who the hell is Alan Leshner, who is Dr. Ricarte, and what are they doing with John Hopkins and the Congress and the investigation of MDMA? Tell us what that's all about and what these guys, do they have any real motivation for their findings?
Well, that's a fantastic question, Dean, and many people hopefully have heard how there was a recent retraction that Dr. Ricarte, who his career has been built since 1984 on looking at what's harmful about MDMA in terms of the brain. He was the one that first discovered MDMA neurotoxicity. He was the one that his research was used back in 1985 to justify the criminalization of MDMA by the Drug Enforcement Administration on an emergency basis. Alan Leshner was a scientist who became the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. And in some ways, he's been considered the most successful director at NIDA in its history because he was instrumental in dramatically increasing the budget every year. Now it's somewhere like $900 million a year.
Wow.
To study various aspects of the what's wrong with drugs of abuse and drug treatment, drug education efforts. It's enormous. And he built it up by basically scaring parents about the dangers of drugs, also by testifying in Congress about the dangers of these drugs, and by turning the National Institute on Drug Abuse from a purely scientific organization to an well, it never really was purely scientific, but from turning it to one that had a fairly good reputation for trying to do unbiased scientific research to one that really acted in service of the drug war, exaggerated the findings of negative studies, and Alan Leshner testified in a misleading way in front of the Senate Subcommittee on Government Affairs about MDMA, talking about the effect of MDMA on cerebral blood flow when he, I believe, knew that there was no long-term effect on it, no difference between MDMA users and controls, and yet he presented data to suggest that that wasn't the case, that there were differences. I mean, he just was tremendous from the point of view of pandering to politicians, increasing the budget, and his main protege, you could say, in terms of what's wrong with MDMA was George Ricarte and then also his wife, Dr. Una McCann. And they were the ones that did the research that showed that they published in Science that claimed that MDMA affected dopamine, which could happen at a common recreational dose, that people could have reduced dopamine levels, and that that could lead to Parkinson's. It was major fear. It was promoted in Science. The reason that it ended up in Science is because after Alan Leshner had had this dramatically successful career at NIDA, he was offered a job as the head of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, very reputable scientific group, AAAS it's called, and one of the things that they do is they publish the journal Science. So we have Alan Leshner moving over to Science, and then as the lead article in September, one of the very well-publicized big press releases, MDMA, even in common recreational doses, even a night's worth, could give you reduced dopamine, could lead to Parkinson's. And that was all over the place. And what has happened recently, earlier in the month in September, is that Dr. Ricarte was forced to issue a retraction of that study. Apparently what happened, what he claims happened, is that somehow or other they had two bottles of, one was methamphetamine and one was MDMA, and the contents got switched. And instead of giving these monkeys that they used for this experiment MDMA, they mistakenly gave them methamphetamine. And then when they gave them MDMA, they, to try to replicate the results orally, because they had done it by injection, they couldn't find any neurotoxicity. And they kept looking at it. They injected the MDMA, still no neurotoxicity, and they finally figured out that they'd administered the wrong drug. Now, this is after $1 million, 25 monkeys have died, about massive scandal. Other papers have to be retracted. And what it showed to a lot of scientists in scientific journals all over the world is that they never should have believed their findings in the first place. They ignored human evidence that showed that there was no effect of MDMA and dopamine. Unbelievable that they just didn't even cite that in their paper. So they went to try to demonize MDMA, to say, to raise more fears at the same time that Congress was dealing with the RAVE Act, which was, you know, a hysterical piece of legislation, questionably constitutional, certainly designed to maximize the harm it raves. No, in no sense is it designed to help out, criminalizing chill out rooms and other things that could be seen as signs that promoters knew that drug use was there, but actually substantially reduce potential risks. And so we have this whole combination of the scientific research funded by NIDA trying to demonize MDMA, then this prior supposedly reputable journal, Science, among the most reputable journals in America in this area, and then they went overboard to promote this article that was very poorly written and poorly argued in the first place. And then now they've had to retract it. And so now we see that the serotonin research that George Riccardi had done that was used by NIDA when Leshner was the head in their advertising campaigns, anti-ecstasy, they had postcards, plain brain, brain after ecstasy, that showed that the brain after ecstasy was just tremendously reduced in the amount of serotonin, that study, published in Lancet, major PET scan study funded by NIDA, that now that we look closely at that study itself is fundamentally flawed, has not been replicated by larger and better controlled studies. So we have the collapse of the hysterical fears about MDMA, but, and this is sort of the way it always goes, we're left with the laws that were passed when people like Alan Leshner exaggerated the risks to Congress, when George Riccardi exaggerated the risks to the scientific community. Now we're left with the burden of that massive repressive structure built on misinformation. But I do think that over the next 10 or 20 years or so, we'll be able to undo that.
Rick, I we're going to have to leave it there. I'm going to have to invite you back again soon. We are just out of time. I thought it was a great discussion, and I appreciate you so much being here with us.
Well, thank you, Dean, very much.
Pot is a gateway drug, unlike vodka and cigarettes.
Ooh, it's a vodka.
Woo!
Cheers.
Vodka!
Cheers. I'm talking about the hard stuff. Hey. Pot makes you lazy. Turns you into a liar and a thief.
Oh.
What kind of pot are you smoking exactly? Because it sounds awful, whatever it is. Come on, man. The laws are much worse than the plan ever was.
Haven't we all smoked pot at some point?
Yeah. Speak for yourself. Whiskey's just fine for me. Thank you very much.
Come on, it's all the same.
It's not the same. Pot's illegal. I think these drug dealers ought to be hung in the middle of town square.
That was a segment from Relief, a short movie that we'll have the director in here soon, Michael Diallo. As always, because of drug prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. So please, please, be careful.
For the Drug Truth Network, and on behalf of my technical producer, Steve Nolan, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth. This show is produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston, Texas.